All right. Seems a little wonky. So if at any point I'm hard to hear, you know, maybe somebody in the back, raise your hand and I'll just speak up a little bit. So I wanted to share today, to speak today a little bit about one's relationship to the unknown. So how one might face or interface with that which lies beyond our current experience somehow. How comfortable we are with uncertainty. How willing we are to open. Kind of what's involved there. So that is a of central importance to us as meditators. Part of what we're doing is choosing to put ourselves kind of face to face with something beyond our current experience. That definitely sums up, you know, the path of cultivating insight and wisdom. So I'll share a little bit from that perspective of our spiritual path, our meditative path. And I also would like to bring in a little bit from the artist perspective or the artist path. There's something about, again, that relationship to the unknown, to uncertainty, how we might be skilled there, that is fundamental to opening to creative process somehow. So hopefully it will be, you know, at least a little different, a little interesting. So I'll start with a quote from Pema Chodron. As soon as you begin to believe in something, then you can no longer see anything else. The truth you believe in and cling to makes you unavailable to hear anything new. So when we begin to practice, and when we take this seat, be willing to kind of tread into unknown waters, uncharted territory somehow, that's part of our job as meditators. Somehow find a way to rest, set down the part of our mind that needs to evaluate, needs to be certain, needs to judge. And in doing that, it's not just a matter of doing that in order to get more info, get more data about our experience. We're also asking ourselves to somehow take a different stance relative to our experience. So it's not just about more information. It's also about somehow being willing to take different stances, to see differently. One way that I think about Buddhist meditative instructions, the practice instructions, they're kind of a recipe or a rule set for taking this different perspective. So just the possibility that we attend to our present moment experience is a very different way of relating to our experience than what we normally do. You know, the normal human, you know, operating procedure, evaluating, assessing, judging, kind of running a narrative concurrently with our experience. Instead, we are intentionally being present with our bodies, with our senses, what's coming to us that way, our emotional experience, you know. So that allows for this possibility for something new to come in. There's teachings and kind of suggestions that come to us from teachers. In the Zen tradition, there's the idea of the beginner's mind. The famous quote from Shunryo Suzuki, "In the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities, but in the expert's, there are few." You know, it's a helpful kind of shading on taking that stance, that fresh stance, where there's a possibility for something else to happen, to go beyond what we know. Sometimes when I hear instructions like that, I kind of pick them up in a way that is like a judgment against myself. You know, like here I go again, needing to be the expert. It's not so helpful. What I find is more helpful for myself is to let myself kind of move in the direction of what is joyful, you know, what kind of speaks to me in that idea, the beginner's mind, you know, the childlike wonder, freshness, possibility, a journey starting. So something more like that. There's an artist who came to mind for me as I was preparing this talk. I don't know if any of you have been able to visit Watts Towers. So they're in the neighborhood of Watts here in Los Angeles. And they were made by a man who, he wasn't an artist until he started that project. It was the only art that he made. It took him over 30 years. When you visit, I encourage you to, if you never have, you go through a residential neighborhood, and you go down a street, and you pass by houses and the driveways, and then it's this very unique, very,
it's a must-see.
It's a must-see, yeah. Yeah. It's not like anything else, in a way. It has a kind of quality of like a cathedral in a way. It's like a sort of some sort of sacred monument, but it also has this playfulness, this spontaneity in it. So he wasn't a trained artist. He apparently didn't plan it out. He didn't do any preparatory drawings, and he came up with the method of construction on his own. And it's big. It's like a small city, and he took rebar and bent it, like steel bars, and he bent it in these swirls and arcs and arches, spires, and then he covered that with cement, and then he embellished the cement with like pieces of broken glass and tile and found objects, and it's just delightful. I read a little about, his name was Simon Rodia, or Rodia, I'm not sure how to say it. I read a little about his life. Some of the biographical details made it sound like a difficult life. You know, he was estranged from his family and his children. He apparently had a significant drinking problem and just came to a point where he wanted to, you know, do something big. That's, I think, what he said, you know, do something grand. And so he really took a different turn, having been, you know, a laborer with this kind of situation. And he worked for over 30 years. And when I have gone there, I've been there a couple times, and you walk into it, I don't know if he was happy when he made it or what was going on for him, but there is something communicated to me that has this quality of freedom, you know, has this quality of spontaneity, of whimsy. It's almost like I can see him building it and, like, deciding what, you know, whatever he fancied he was going to affix to the side that day. You know, it's so something about it is, to me, a kind of, like, manifestation or embodiment of this possibility of the beginner's mind. I have a book by Chogyam Trungpa, if you're familiar with him. He's a very interesting teacher. And this book is about art and art relative to Dharma practice. So he gave a series of talks. He was apparently a photographer, and they're really interesting talks. And there was one thing in there that particularly kind of stood out to me. And it's the way that he described art that was somehow less than living up to its Dharma potential. You know, he used the word aggressive to describe that art. So he said, he defined aggressive art. It wasn't bad art, like the way we normally think of bad art, which is like, oh, that's made by someone who's talentless or, you know, unskilled or something. He wasn't concerned with that. He was concerned with where the intention for the art to be made, you know, where that came from. Did it come from an egoic place? Did the artists make it because they needed to somehow assert what a good artist they were, how talented they were, how, you know, meaningful their ideas were, something like that. When art came from that place, in his mind, you know, that was an act of aggression towards the viewer somehow. Wasn't an invitation. Yeah. Wasn't, if art was made from a place maybe more of this willingness to set down my need to, you know, say X, Y, Z about myself or know this to be true, if the art was made from a place of vulnerability or openness or somehow, you know, communicating from this place of recognizing this human predicament somehow and kind of inviting someone into our perspective there, that kind of art with that kind of bravery in a way, in his mind, would be more of a gift to the viewer. You know, it's an invitation. You know, very much that Watts Tower, you know, I felt invited in somehow to, you know, the man's no longer alive, but you know, somehow there, it touched me in that way that was a kind of a gift, a communication of a gift. So I think, you know, I wouldn't use the term aggressive. Chogyam Trungpa is, you know, very fond of hyperbole and this kind of, you know, fierce, like, this is how it is. I probably think that most art has, you know, has a combination of reasons why it's made. But I think we can recognize that aliveness, you know, that gift when we see it, you know, when we feel it, maybe in art, but also in actions, you know, in our own actions. We can feel when we're moving from that kind of vulnerability, responsiveness, freshness, versus this kind of like, you know, here's who I am. I notice, like, for myself, sometimes if I am at a party and I'm in a mood where I feel a little guarded for whatever reason, and I'll meet a bunch of people that I don't know, it's almost like I'm, you know, like reading my resume or like giving my bio. You know, I'll say like, oh yeah, I'm Susie, I do this, I do that, I'm married to this person, I live here, I've lived in LA for X, and I'll meet a series of people. It'll be this kind of, you know, regurgitation of a script. It's not what I want, you know, it's not pleasant for me, it's not really that interesting for the other person. And then at other times, for whatever reason, I'm able to sort of be less guarded. And it's like I can almost kind of walk into someone's life for a minute, and they can walk into mine. There's a spontaneity. The exchange becomes a little bit more like a poem instead of like a, you know, exchanging info or something like that. This is another quote from Pema Chodron. She's talking about moving towards the unknown. If our edge is like a huge stone wall with a door in it, how do we learn to open that door and step through it again and again so that life becomes a process of growing up, becoming more and more fearless and flexible, more and more able to play like a raven in the wind? So again, pointing to this need to practice, this need to, you know, learn to move, walk in a different way, setting down the certainty, opening with freshness, opening with presentness. But she also gives us this beautiful poetic image of the raven in the wind. And I think there's, you know, there's something in us that can sense what that is like, what's possible there. In Mahayana Buddhism, there's the idea of the Buddha nature, you know. Sometimes this is defined as the capacity that all sentient beings have to awaken, to become enlightened. And I think there's a part of us that can kind of hear, recognize that kind of freedom when we touch it. And that recognition can be a support for us and our willingness to move in. Because that's what becomes available when we are able to set certain things down, to kind of unburden ourselves of what we've collected that limit us, you know, wherever we've received it. You're thinking in the Buddha nature kind of way of describing practice, you know, we're revealing, we're dismantling what obscures that somehow. There's a Sufi poet named Rumi who probably many of you are familiar with. And there's something about his teachings and his poetry that kind of, to me, just kind of goes right to that part of me that can sort of recognize a possibility beyond where I'm already operating. So I'll read just a few lines from him. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. So, you know, beyond this need to evaluate, something else shared to us as a poetic image that can also be a kind of guide, you know, that when something connects to us that way. So I received a very good piece of advice from a teacher. I've received more than one good piece of advice from teachers, but this one is kind of relative to what I'm talking about in terms of my own personal path. And he said that I should contemplate the emptiness of that which is compelling to me, you know, that those aspects of my life that have a lot of meaning, or maybe are very maddening somehow, but that's the area that can be really fruitful for us to explore in order to gain this kind of really deep insight that can be liberating for us. For me, my art practice, my relationship to art was one of those things. So I started drawing and painting when I was a kid, as everybody does, but I didn't stop, and it actually became more important to me when I was in like junior high, middle school, so 12, 13, you know, a time of life where I was really getting in touch with this comparing mind, judging mind, you know, what is it to put myself out in the world, what is it to feel, you know, inadequate, or to question, am I likable enough, or smart enough, or attractive enough? That becomes very heightened. And art was somehow a kind of refuge for me. You know, I'd come home from school and go in the garage and shut the door, and I would paint, and it was a joyful experience for me. It was kind of a refuge. Had a quality, when I look back, it had a quality of a kind of sacredness somehow, though I wouldn't have used those words at the time. Decided when I was 17 to go to art school, and I went to a really competitive art school. And it was kind of a rude awakening for me. I wished I'd been older when I went, because there was a lot of wonderful things there. But it was intense, you know. It was all, everybody at the school had also been the best artist in their high school, you know. The teachers were professional artists who showed at, you know, famous galleries in New York. We were putting our work up on the wall, you know, every week, and having public critiques. You know, the stakes were very high for me, and it began to kind of close down my ability to keep that relationship, to keep this openness to the unknown, to possibility. By the end of art school, I'd stopped painting, probably for about 10 or 12 years, although I kept wanting to, you know, and I would try, and I would, like, set up a place to do it somehow, but, you know, it's that kind of artist block, creative block, and maybe we've experienced that in our own lives with areas, maybe you're an artist, maybe it's other areas where somehow you take a kind of delight in experience, and for whatever reason, you know, that has closed down because of, you know, other factors. So that was that space for me. I began meditating and became a Dharma practitioner in my early 30s, and that was a place where I began to do a little bit of this unburdening myself somehow of those things that had closed me down and have the space to examine that. Began to decrease my suffering too, you know. It was difficult, challenging, but very clearly worthwhile to me, so a real joy to find that. And I did start painting again a little bit for myself, in different ways, when I started opening that up for myself with practice. I decided to do, maybe 3-4 years in, I saw a listing for a retreat at Spirit Rock, and I'd been practicing in Zen. People had said Spirit Rock's like this really lovely place to go practice, and hadn't done Vipassana meditation, so I signed up. And I was really curious, what is this art and meditation thing? Because it was this creativity retreat. I had some idea that it might be like Zen calligraphy or something like that. Didn't know. When I'd done other art workshops and things like that, they usually began by doing a demo, and they'd show you, you know, this is what we're going to do. We're doing watercolor portraits, and then the instructor would show you what it was, and then you'd kind of learn this new skill and move on. This isn't what happened at this creativity retreat at all. Instead, what we were given was almost like a set of rules, and a lot of them are what we shouldn't do. And the instructions really came into contradiction with what I felt I was an expert about, you know, how to make a beautiful painting. The first thing that actually really ticked me off, when we got there, we were given our materials, and we were given poster paints, like kids, like tempera paints, and we were painting on paper. And I was like, okay, we're going to paint for 7 days, and I'm going to use these, you know, the crummy kids' materials. Being on a silent meditation retreat at the time, I was able to kind of see what was underneath that anger. And I could see there was a part of me that had the hope or the expectation somehow that every time I sat down in front of a blank canvas, the possibility would be that I would create a masterpiece of sorts somehow, you know, and that would change the course of my life somehow. Maybe it would get, I'd be able to sell it for a lot of money, or I'd be able to get it in a gallery and things would go a certain way. It was really unacknowledged. But when they took away the professional art materials, it revealed that. Was a different, kind of forced into a different space. They also, they took away my palette. So, you know, I was used to setting up my colors in a certain way and picking colors that I knew how they worked. So, you know, a certain blue mixed with a certain yellow, I could get a kind of effect. So you could kind of control it and start from what felt to me to be a higher level. And instead, we were just given two paintbrushes, and the paints were, the cups of children paint were in the middle of the room, and we would have to walk over and get each brushful and then go back to the painting. Each brush stroke then, or each choice of color, each time the brush emptied, it was sort of an invitation to be again and again freshly with a kind of uncertainty, you know? My plan was gone, my palette was gone, and instead I had to look to my being somehow, look to how I responded to the choice, what color called me, what felt alive. It was really different. So sort of aligning myself with the process of painting versus my idea of this thing I'm going to make that is going to have this important, you know, result or make people say wonderful things to me, whatever it was. Very different, just aligning very differently somehow. Some of the other rules were things like you weren't allowed to sketch out and make a balanced composition. You know, that's what I would usually start. I wouldn't want to do a figure and have it be like out of balance or deformed looking. That would be very embarrassing to me. So, but instead, we weren't allowed to erase, we weren't allowed to fix, we weren't allowed to sketch out, we weren't allowed to stand back and evaluate. So instead, the emphasis was on keeping that kind of intimacy and connection and, like, how am I doing in this process? It was really different. It really blew my mind. It was very challenging. It was also challenging for other, maybe more challenging for people who were still professional artists, you know? I had already kind of given up in a way, but it was very beautiful. They encouraged you, you were not allowed to comment to anybody about their painting, so you couldn't say, this is beautiful, there was no critiques. You were told that it would be ideal if you would not show people your paintings after the retreat for like 3 or 4 or 5 years, you know, which, again, to kind of, that was the ideal. It was, I didn't do it. I had to show someone. But you were also, maybe the most challenging thing for me, but you weren't allowed to stop. So you weren't allowed to take a break. You weren't allowed to, you know, you had lunch break and stuff like that, but you had to find a way to keep moving. This is very much like the instruction we get as meditators, you know. We commit to whatever, 45 minutes, and write it out, whatever comes up. That's very important to learn, to find a way to sit beyond the point where we feel like we need to act. This point where somehow it starts to push us beyond what we know. And for me, that happened with the painting. So I began to see that normally I would take a lot of breaks. And I would take breaks when a kind of anxiety or a fear would come up. And I could see that that anxiety or fear was usually related to moving into an area that I wasn't sure how I was going to handle, or making something that seemed to me like a mistake. And then continuing, I began to hear what I was telling myself. You know, what was it that made me take the break? And they were things like, you know, you're going to F it up again. You're ruining this. You're making this ugly. Whatever. That was the kind of tone. I think that kind of experience is very familiar to most people who've committed to their meditation practice. You know, we begin to hang in there long enough to hear what's going on in there, to question where did it come from, whose is it, what's the purpose, is this serving me? It was pretty clear to me by the end of that week that wasn't a very fruitful environment for encouraging like playfulness and spontaneity. So it was for me a really transformative experience. We were told at the end of the retreat, we're given some instructions on how we might take the practice home with us and how we might continue working this way. Again, similar to what you would get at a meditation retreat, where they give you suggestions on how to kind of set up and maybe preserve a meditative practice. And they said the best thing, especially if you were an artist who already worked creatively in another way, would be to set up a time to just purely follow the instructions. And then kind of trust that this kind of exploration would percolate out somehow, start to somehow imbue other ways that you work creatively, and possibly into how you relate it in your life in terms of facing uncertainty, what you are willing to kind of do there. The last thing they said, one thing I remember that was really, I did not like it at all when I heard it at first, but they said, you may choose to paint this way instead of focusing on making a product. You know, you may choose to kind of align yourself with the process and not no longer be concerned with what you make. And that idea, I really didn't like it at all, you know, because I needed so much to get what I was getting from the paintings. But over time, I did continue painting this way and did continue to see more joy for myself open. And also the art itself was impacted, you know, kind of in the way that Chogyam Trungpa is pointing to. It began to be a gift to me. It began to surprise me. It began to be more touching, be more open somehow. As meditators, there is a kind of parallel to that, what I described there, my journey with the art making. When we begin to be willing to hang in there, open to uncertainty, be with ourselves beyond the point at which we need to make a decision, need to act somehow, we begin to see that it's possible for that certainty to kind of soften somehow. These imperatives become something we can question. You know, they become more flexible for us. If I'm sitting and I begin to have a strong thought about someone who having some kind of disagreement with, and I'm able to sit beyond the point where I want to get up and call them or somehow fix it. When we can do that, we begin to open up to more perspectives, more possibilities somehow. Maybe there are other options in the way that we need to act. Maybe that strong feeling will just kind of fade and dissipate somehow, not even be a concern. Maybe we'll begin to see, oh, that strong reaction is related to other factors come together. sometimes we can begin to see the other person's perspective a little bit too when we've dropped the certainty and kind of found a way to open. When we are really acting from this place of needing to be certain for whatever reason, it can kind of give our experience this linear sense, you know, this sense there's only one way to go. I've got to figure out the right decision, and then I'm going to keep moving from there. You know, it's a very limited perspective. It's very fragile. You know? It doesn't have a lot of this kind of quality of aliveness somehow. When in different ways we soften, we begin to be okay with the uncertainty, that's when these other perspectives sort of come up, and it gives a quality of possibility. Yeah. So maybe the straight line, the point to point, becomes more of a web of possibility somehow. Or it kind of opens up into a field of possibility. There's these different perspectives. We can become comfortable there. It can become a nourishing place. When there is this opening of the possibility, we're freer to act in ways that support what we want to put forth. If we're facing, you know, this blank page, we can make marks from a different place, not from somehow being compelled to do it based on our unquestioned ideas. Instead, it can come from the spontaneity and the care or the love or the artfulness or the beauty. You know, there's room for that. So, thank you, guys. We do have time if anyone has any questions about practice or something you'd like to share into the space about your own practice or something that you'd like to ask me. Hi.
Hi, the name of the book, Photography, Provided Photography.
Oh, it's a book by Chogyam Trungpa, who is a very well-known Tibetan Buddhist teacher, so no longer alive. But he's the one who founded Shambhala. Right? The book is called, holy moly. No. It is called, gosh, I don't know, it's not coming to me, but it is... the focus of it is on art somehow. So if you were to Google his name and like book on art, that's the one you would get. And I'm sorry, I don't have the title. Yeah. He was Pema Chodron's teacher. He was Reggie Ray's teacher. He's very one of the first Tibetans to come to the United States, and so it has had a big influence.
Pema also, I read one.
Oh.
It was just basically like how to meditate. I think that's the title it had.
Yeah, I love her books. They're very clear, but kind of deep. You know,
they're really really good. She stuck out to me the most. All the authors. Yeah.
Oh, wonderful, cool.
Mm-hmm. I was gonna ask you about the painting. What did you end up painting?
What were my paintings of?
Yeah, what was it of?
I did many of them, and they were images. There were a lot of figures. There were a lot of I probably did like 7 on that first retreat. So just a lot of things moving through, a lot of strange stuff that was very different than the other things that I painted, somehow. So,
What were you like? Used to
paint. I paint people. You know, I did a lot of portraits that were like this. Even when I made them up, they kind of followed that format. And so one of the things that was really significant for me is I painted like these multiple figures in an environment. I didn't even know that I could do that, you know. I had kind of locked down what my expectations were. So yeah, it was really...
Oh, you mean at the retreat?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was very different. Yeah, they were very different, very surprising.
I draw myself, so that's why I was. It was something that caught my attention. You do it with paintbrushes, but I haven't really had the chance to do it with paintbrushes too much.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I draw pen and pencil.
Oh, wonderful. Yes.
Just real quick to kind of recap what I heard from you, which was wonderful. Thank you for connecting it with the art. Is basically to give up the control and to embrace the unknown is where you find the deepest joy. And thank you, because that's wonderful, because there's so many times as an artist you want to control everything. You think this is what I can do, and I do this so damn good that no one's going to tell me anything better. Then you realize that there's so much more that you're just closing the door on.
Yeah.
So thank you very much. It was very inspiring.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, I'm glad to hear it. It's,
and it's not just art, is it? It's the world today.
No, I mean, I definitely thought a little bit about, like, holding on to certainty and what that blocks as possible in relative to the current news, you know? Feels like there's nothing new is going to happen when there is that kind of locking on. It is also very subtly this same perspective, you know, for an artist, it's like, I was talking a little bit about, you know, there were, once I set down kind of my imperatives, paintings appeared that I couldn't even have anticipated somehow, and that was shocking to me. As meditators, this same kind of thing holds true on a big level in terms of our ideas about who we are, what's possible for us, but also on a very subtle level in terms of what we're even able to perceive with our senses. You know, when we hold certain ideas about how things are, how my body feels to me, my experience of sound is, you know, on this very subtle level, it will color what we're able to see and perceive, you know. So exploring that way consciously, it can open up a lot for us as meditators too, in ways that are kind of just as, you know, shocking somehow. Yeah, well, I'm glad it was interesting. Yes?
I found it interesting that the way to get beyond the mind and all its sort of things you can and can't do was actually by following a different set of rules that were also really rigid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the paints and the poster paints and the other, and that was really good. That, you know, they talk about breaking the mind with the mind.
Yeah.
You know? And there's also a lovely Native American prayer which says, "You whose day it is, make it beautiful. Get out your rainbow colors so it will be beautiful." And it I imagine it is us, we are the you that they're talking about, and kind of talks to what you're saying.
Yeah, lovely. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah.
And it, for the first time, too, you made me want to go to Watts and see the towers. I've lived that in 35 years.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Can you actually walk in there and tour it? Or
it's
from the outside?
Unless they're at different times they've been doing renovations, but most of the time it's open, and it's there's a center there that has hours, and it's got a wall, but you can go inside, and then some of the areas, there's one part that is sort of like a central, it's like a dome, you know, it's all kind of skeletal and covered in this mosaic, but you can go in there and you can sit, you can look up and just sort of be in the middle of it.
Yeah. I've only seen it from the Blue Line train.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I haven't been there for a while. They may have more information at the museum, but just in sort of the cursory research I did is, you know, he basically, I watched a little video that had a few quotes from him. There's probably not a lot of documentation. And he said, you know, I was a very bad person, you know, I made a lot of mistakes. And so I wanted to do something big. You know, people want something big. I wanted to, you know, do something else. That's about it, you know, that I could find. And then it's just this kind of flood of, you know, what came out of him and the specific way he executed it and the choices he made. But yeah, that's about all I know.
To the again, going to the top of it was aggressive. I forgot who Trump.
Yeah.
Trump.
Yeah.
He called it aggressive. I guess aggressive would be like trying to prove something. I guess, trying to prove something to our art.
Yes.
In the way, and also in a meditative way, also looking at it, the way we paint everything that we see.
Mm-hmm.
So aggressiveness would be in our trying to control.
Yeah. Yeah. Or trying to just say and not listen somehow, you know, something like that. Trying to assert, you know, it's like, it's a little much the way, you know, the word aggressive. It's a little like, you know, it's a little aggressive. We're all trying to do our best, you know. We've picked up these ideas and we feel we need to hold them because we want to protect ourselves, you know. We want to. You know, there's nothing wrong with that impulse. You know, what becomes wrong is what we lose. Yeah, what becomes not possible.
Yeah.
So, So that's why I kind of don't like that word, but there's something about it too that I kind of get too. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I just want to thank you for this talk because it really has broadened the lens with which to look at these terrible current events, which you didn't touch, but you illuminated. Thank you.
You are welcome. And I thought about it, you know, I was like, okay, I have this talk, I've kind of worked on it already, and you know, should I open it up? And I made the decision not to, but it was, you know, on my mind, yeah, very much, and very much, I do see this, you know, movement of somehow getting outside of what we feel we need to be certain about, you know, it is very much related to what we inherit somehow from the society, you know, from the things that we are given, the imperatives that come outside. And unfortunately, we have to do that job ourselves, you know, of beginning to liberate ourselves enough to see the problem, right? Yeah. So, yeah, you're welcome. Thank you very much.
They change facilitators. Last week I came. Do they usually change from week to week?
Oh, on Sundays we have the guiding teacher here is Jokai Blackwell. So he
was here last week.
Yes,
yeah.
And so he goes every other week. So he's here the most often, and it kind of provides like the through line of teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And then there'll be other teachers. The schedule is a little, you know, it's irregular. So other teachers who teach here might give a Dharma talk usually on the other days, yeah. So, you know, I teach, sometimes I've taught the beginner's class here, or I'll do various workshops, and it kind of, so Jokai's kind of the regular, and then there's the rest of us kind of, yeah, show up from time to time. And they usually post, if you get on the mailing list, they'll say, you know, who's giving the talk on Sunday, basically, so... And have you been to the other weekly offerings here?
No.
Okay. So I do come on Wednesday. I come once a month on the third Wednesday, and there's other teachers who alternate for that. And then we have a beginner's guided practice on Monday too. So yeah. But the talk is the Sunday. Mm. You're welcome. Okay, guys, unless anybody else feels like throwing their voice out there.